The little man tilted his head from side to side as he said the words. "Maybe my ass. I'll find them myself." She stepped toward the steel door. "That door is locked, Miss Warner." "So unlock it." "Not possible. It must be locked while a suspect is questioned." "Suspect? I want a lawyer right now." "You are in Jakarta, Miss Warner." "No lawyer. No call to the American Embassy." The man continued looking down, picking dirt off his boots. "We have many foreigners here, many visitors, many people who come here, who do not respect our country, our people. Before we fear American consulate, we give them lawyer. They always get away. We learn. Indonesians are not being as stupid as you think, Miss Warner. That is why you do your work here, is it not? You think we are too stupid to figure out what you are up to?" "I'm not up to anything. I'm trying to cure autism." "Why not do that in your own country, Miss Warner?" Kate would never, in a million years, tell this man why she had left America. Instead, she said, "America is the most expensive place in the world to conduct a clinical trial." "Ah, then it is about the cost, yes? Here in Indonesia, you can buy babies to experiment on?" "I haven't bought any babies." "But your trial owns these children, does it not?" He turned the file around and pointed at it. Kate followed his finger. "Miss Warner, your trial is the legal guardian of both of these children, of all 103, is it not?" "Legal guardianship is not ownership." "You use different words. So did the Dutch East India Corporation. Do you know of it?" "I'm sure you do. They used the word colony, but they owned Indonesia for over 200 years. A corporation owned my country and its people, and they treated us as their property, taking what they wanted. In 1947, we finally got our independence, but the memory is still raw for many people. A jury will see this as just the same. You did take these children, did you not? You said it yourself. You did not pay for them. And I see no record of the parents. They gave no consent to the adoption. Do they even know you have their children?" Kate stared hard at him. "I thought so. We are getting somewhere now. It is best to be honest. One last thing, Miss Warner. I see that your research is funded by Imari Jakarta Research Division. It is probably only coincidence, but very unfortunate. Imari Holdings purchased many of the assets of the Dutch when they were driven out 65 years ago. So the money from your work came from..." The man stuffed the pages in the folder and stood, as if he were an Indonesian Perry Mason, making his closing argument. "You can see how a jury might see this, Miss Warner. Your people leave but return with a new name and continue to exploit us. Instead of sugarcane and coffee beans in the 1900s, now you want new drugs. You need new guinea pigs to experiment on. You take our children, run experiments. You could not run in your own country, because you will not do this to your own children, and when something goes wrong, maybe a child gets sick, or you think the authorities will find out, you get rid of these children. But something goes wrong. Maybe one of your technicians cannot kill these children. He knows it is wrong. He fights back, and he is killed in the struggle. You know the police will come, so you make up this story about the kidnapping. Yes. You can admit this. It will be better. Indonesia is a merciful place." "It's not true." "It is the most logical story, Miss Warner. You give us no alternative. You ask for your lawyer. You insist we release you. Think about how this looks." Kate stared at him. The man stood and made for the door. "Very well, Miss Warner. I must warn you, what follows will not be pleasant. It is best to cooperate. But of course, you clever Americans always know best." Chapter 11. Imari Corp. Research Complex. Outside Bereng, China, Tibet Autonomous Region.
"Wake up, Jen. They're calling your number."
Jen tried to open his eyes, but the light was blinding. His roommate huddled over him, whispering something in his ear, but he couldn't make it out. In the background, a booming voice called over the loudspeaker,
204-394, report immediately. 204-394, report immediately. 204-394. 204-394, report.
Jen leapt out of the small bed. How long had they been calling him? His eyes darted left and right, searching the 3-meter by 3-meter cell he shared with Wei. Where were his pants and shirt? Please, no. If he was late and forgot his outfit, they would kick him out for sure. Where were they? Where? His roommate, sitting on his bunk, held up the white cloth pants and shirt. Jen snatched them and pulled them on, almost ripping the pants. Wei stared at the floor. Sorry, Jen. I was asleep, too. I didn't hear. Jen wanted to say something, but there wasn't time. He ran out of the room and down the hall. Several of the cells were empty, and most had only one occupant. At the door to the wing, the orderly said, Arm. Jen held out his arm. 204-394. Quiet, the man said. He waved a handheld device with a small screen over Jen's arm. It beeped, and the man turned his head and yelled, That's it. He opened the door for Jen. Go ahead. Jen joined about 50 other residents. 3 orderlies escorted them to a large room with several long rows of chairs. The rows were separated by tall, cubicle-like walls. The chairs looked almost like reclining beach chairs. Beside each chair, a tall silver pole held 3 bags of clear liquid, each with a tube hanging down. On the other side of each chair stood a machine with more readouts than a car dashboard and a bundle of wires hanging from the bottom, tied off on the right chair rail. Jen had never seen anything like it. It never happened like this. Since he had arrived at the facility 6 months ago, the daily routine had rarely changed. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner at the exact same times, always the same meals. After each meal, blood draws from the valve-like device they had implanted in his right arm, and sometimes exercise in the afternoon, monitored by electrodes on his chest. The rest of the time, they were confined to the 3-meter by 3-meter cells, with 2 beds and a toilet. Every few days or so, they took a picture of him with a big machine that made a low droning sound. They were always saying for him to lie still. They showered once per week in a large co-ed group shower. That was by far the worst part, trying to control the urges in the shower. During his first month, a couple was caught fooling around. No one ever saw them again. Last month, Jen had tried to stay in his cell during shower time, but they had caught him. The supervisor had stormed into his cell. "We'll kick you out if you disobey again," he had said. Jen was scared to death. They were paying him $2 per day. A fortune, an absolute fortune. And he had no other options. His family had lost their farm near Barang. No one could afford the taxes on a small farm anymore. A larger farm, maybe. Land values were skyrocketing, and the population was swelling throughout China. So his family did what many other farm families had done, sent their oldest for work in the city, while the parents and younger children held on. His older brother found work in a factory making electronics. Jin and his parents visited him a month after he started. The conditions were much worse than here, and the work was already taking its toll. The strong, vibrant 21-year-old man who had left his family's farm looked to have aged 20 years. He was pale, his hair was thinning, and he walked with a slight stoop. He coughed constantly. He said there had been a bug at the factory and everyone in his barracks had gotten it, but Jin didn't believe him. His brother gave his parents $15 he had saved from his 75-cent-a-day salary. Just think, in 5 to 10 years, I'll have enough to buy us another farm. I'll come home, and we'll start again. They had all acted very excited. His parents had said they were so proud of him. On their way home, Jen's father told them that tomorrow he would go and find better work. that with his skills he could surely make supervisor somewhere. He'd make good money. Jen and his mother simply nodded. That night, Jen heard his mother crying, and shortly after his father shouting. They never fought. The next night, Jen slipped out of his room, wrote them a note, and left for Chongqing, the nearest major city. The city was filled with people looking for work, and they weren't kind to newcomers. The lines were long, and assuming you were tough enough to muscle your way into line, you were rarely hired. Jen was turned down at the first 7 places he applied. The 8th place was different. They had line monitors that made sure no one applying got beat up. They didn't ask any questions. They put a cotton stick in his mouth and made him wait in a large holding room for an hour. Most of the people were dismissed. After another hour, they called his number, 204394, and told him they could hire him at a medical research facility for $2 a day. He signed the forms so fast his hand cramped. He couldn't believe his luck. He assumed the conditions would be dire, but he couldn't have been more wrong. It was a resort, like one of those American health spas in the magazines they sold in big cities. And now he had screwed it all up. Surely they were kicking him out. They had called his number. Maybe he had enough for a new farm, or maybe he could find another research place. He'd heard that the big factories in China exchanged lists of bad workers. Those people couldn't find work anywhere. That would be the kiss of death. "What the hell are you waiting for?" the man shouted. "Find a seat." Jen and the other 50 or so white-clad, barefooted workers scrambled for chairs. Elbows flew, people pushed, and several people tripped. Everyone seemed to find a chair but Jin. Every time he reached a chair, someone would sink into it at the last second. What if he didn't find a chair? Maybe it was a test. Maybe he should... "People, relax, relax. Mind the equipment," the man said. "Just find the closest chair." Jin exhaled and walked to the next row. Full. In the last row, he found a seat. Another group of orderlies entered. They wore long white coats and carried tablet computers. A young-looking woman came over to him, hooked the bags to his arm valve, and attached the round sensors to his body. She tapped a few times on her screen and moved to the chair beside him. Maybe it was just a new test, he thought. He suddenly felt sleepy. He leaned his head back, and... Jen woke in the same chair. The bags were detached, but the sensors were still connected. He felt groggy and stiff, like he had the flu. He tried to lift his head up. It was so heavy. A white coat came over, ran a flashlight across his eyes, then unhooked the sensors and told him to go and stand with the others by the door. When he stood, his legs almost buckled. He steadied himself on the arm of his chair, then hobbled over to the group. They all looked half asleep. There were maybe 25 of them, about half of the group that had entered. Where were the rest? Had he slept too long, again? Is this punishment? Would they tell him why? After a few minutes, another man joined them. He seemed in even worse shape than Jin and the rest. The orderlies ushered them through another long passageway and into an enormous room he'd never seen before. The room was completely empty, and the walls were very smooth. He got the impression that it was like a vault or something. Several minutes passed. He fought the urge to sit down on the floor. He hadn't been told he could sit. He stood there, his heavy head hanging. The door opened, and 2 children were escorted in. They couldn't have been more than 7 or 8 years old. The guards left them with the group, the door closing behind them with a loud boom. The children weren't drugged, or at least Jen didn't think so. They looked alert. They moved quickly into the crowd of people. They were brown, not Chinese. They both wandered from person to person, trying to find a familiar face. Jen thought they were about to begin crying. At the far end of the room, he heard a mechanical sound like a winch. After a few seconds, he realized something was being lowered. His head was so heavy. He strained to lift it. He could barely see the device. It looked like a massive iron chess pawn with a flat head, or maybe a bell with smooth, straight sides. It must have been 4 meters tall and heavy, because the 4 cables that lowered it were huge, maybe a quarter of a meter around. When it was about 6 meters off the ground, it stopped, and 2 of the cables moved down the wall along a track Jen hadn't noticed before. They stopped about level with the huge machine and seemed to tighten, anchoring it at each side. Jen strained to look up. There was another cable running from the top of the machine. It was even fatter than the ones at the sides. Unlike the others, it wasn't metal, or even solid. It seemed to hold a bundle of wires or computer cables, like some sort of electronic umbilical cord. The children had stopped in the middle of the crowd. All the adults tried to look up. His eyes adjusted, and Jen could just make out a marking etched into the side of the machine. It looked like a Nazi symbol. He couldn't remember the name. He felt so sleepy. The machine was dark, but Jen thought he could hear a faint, throbbing sound, like someone rhythmically beating on a solid door. Boom, boom, boom. Or maybe the sound of the picture machine. Was it a different picture machine? A group picture? The boom, boom, boom grew louder with each passing second, and a light emerged from the top of the giant pawn. Its head apparently had short windows. The yellow-orange light flickered with each pulse of the boom, giving it almost the effect of a lighthouse. Jen was so entranced by the machine's sounds and light pulses, he didn't notice the people falling around him. Something was happening, and it was happening to him, too. His legs felt heavier. He heard a sound like bending metal. The machine was pulling against the cables at each side. It was trying to lift. The pull of the floor got stronger with each passing second. Jen looked around but couldn't see the children. Jen felt someone grab his shoulder. He turned to find a man holding on to him. His face had deep wrinkles, and blood ran from his nose. Jen realized that the skin from the man's hands was coming off on Jen's clothes. It wasn't just skin. The man's blood began to spread over Jen's shirt. The man fell forward onto him, and they both collapsed to the ground. Jen heard the boom, boom, boom of the machine blend into one constant drone of sound and solid light as he felt the blood from his nose run down his face. Then the light and sound suddenly stopped. In the control room, Dr. Chang and his team stood and watched as the test subjects collapsed into a pile of wrinkled, bloody bodies. Chang slumped into his chair. "Okay, that's it. Shut it off." He took his glasses off and tossed them on the table. He pinched the bridge of his nose and exhaled. "I have to report this to the director. The man would not be happy." Chang rose and walked toward the door. "And start the cleanup. Don't bother with autopsies." The result had been the same as the last 25 tests. The 2-man cleanup crew swung back, forth, and released the body, hurling it into the rolling plastic bin. The bin held around 10 bodies, give or take. Today would probably mean 3 trips to the incinerator, maybe 2 if they could stack them on top. They had cleaned up a lot worse. At least these bodies were intact. It took forever when they were in pieces. It was hard to work in the hazmat suits, but it was better than the alternative. They lifted another body and swung forward, then something was moving in the pile. 2 children were struggling under the bodies, fighting to crawl out. They were covered in blood. 1 man began clearing bodies. The other turned to the cameras and waved his arms. "Hey, we've got 2 live ones! Chapter 12. Brig, Clock Tower Station HQ, Jakarta, Indonesia. "Josh, K Can you hear me? Josh Cohen tried to open his eyes, but the light was too bright. His head was throbbing. Here, give me another one. Josh could barely make out a blurry figure sitting by him on a hard bed. Where was he? It looked like one of the station's holding cells. The man brought a pellet to Josh's nose and cracked it open with a loud pop. Josh inhaled the worst smell of his entire life, a sharp, overwhelming ammonia smell that coursed through his airways, inflated his lungs, and sent him reeling backward, hitting his head against the wall. The constant throbbing turned to a sharp pain. He closed his eyes tight and rubbed his head. Okay, okay, take it easy. It was the station chief, David Vale. What's going on? Josh asked. He could open his eyes now, and he realized that David was in full body armor, and there were two other field operatives with him, standing by the door to the cell. Josh sat up. Someone must have planted a bug. Relax, this isn't about a bug. Can you stand up? David said. I think so. Josh struggled to his feet. He was still groggy from the gas that had knocked him out in the elevator. Good. Follow me. Josh followed David and the two operatives out of the room with the holding cells and down a long hallway that led to the server room. At the server room door, David turned to the other two soldiers. Wait here. Radio me if anyone enters the corridor. Inside the server room, David resumed his brisk pace, and Josh had to almost jog to keep up. The station chief was just over 6 feet tall and muscular, not quite as beefy as some of the linebacker-esque ops guys, but big enough to give any drunken bar brawler pause. They snaked their way through the crowded server room, dodging tower after tower of metal cabinets with green, yellow, and red blinking lights. The room was cool, and the constant hum of the machines was slightly disorienting. The three-person IT group was constantly working on the servers, adding, removing, and replacing hardware. The place was a pigsty. Josh tripped over a cord, but before he hit the ground, David turned, caught him, and pushed him back to his feet. You all right? Josh nodded. Yeah. This place is a mess. David said nothing, but walked a bit more slowly the rest of the way to a metal closet at the back of the server room. David pushed the closet aside, revealing a silver door and a panel beside it. The red light of a palm scan flashed over his hand, and another panel opened and performed a facial and retinal scan. When it finished, the wall parted, revealing an iron door that looked like something from a battleship. David opened the iron door with a second palm scan and led Josh into a room probably half the size of a high school gymnasium. The cavern had concrete walls, and their footsteps echoed loudly as they approached the center of the room, where a small glass box, about 12 feet by 12 feet, hung from thick, twisted metal cords. The glass box was softly lit, and Josh couldn't see inside it, but he already knew what it was. Josh had suspected the cell had such a room, but he'd never seen it in person. It was a quiet room. The entire Jakarta Station headquarters was a kind of quiet room. It was shielded from every manner of listening device. There was no need for further precautions within the station, unless you didn't want another member of the cell to hear you. There were certainly protocols that required it. He suspected the chief talked with other station chiefs via phone and video in this room, maybe even with Central. As they approached the room, a short flight of glass stairs descended and quickly retracted after they climbed into the room. A glass door closed behind them. A bank of computer screens hung on the far wall of the room, but other than that, Josh thought the room was surprisingly sparse. A simple fold-out table with four chairs, two phones, and a conference speaker, and an old steel filing cabinet. The furniture was cheap and a bit out of place, like something you might see in the on-site trailer at a construction site. Take a seat, David said. He walked to the file cabinet and withdrew several folders. I have a report to make. It's significant. I think you better let me start. David joined Josh at the table and placed the files between them.
With due respect, what I have to report may change your entire perspective. It may cause a major reassessment, a reassessment of every active operation at Jakarta Station, and even how we analyze every... David held a hand up.
I already know what you're going to tell me.
You do?
I do. You're going to tell me that the vast majority of the terror threats we're tracking, including operations in developed nations that we don't yet understand, aren't the work of a dozen separate terrorist and fundamentalist groups, as we'd suspected. When Josh said nothing, David continued. You're going to tell me that Clock Tower now believes that these groups are all simply different faces of one global supergroup, an organization with a scale exceeding anyone's wildest projections.
They already told you?
Yes. But not recently. I began putting the pieces together before I joined Clock Tower. I was officially told when I made station chief. Josh looked away. It wasn't exactly a betrayal, but realizing something this big had been kept from him, the head of analysis, was a punch in the gut. At the same time, he wondered if he should have put it all together, if David was disappointed that he hadn't figured it out on his own. David seemed to sense Josh's disappointment. For what it's worth, I've wanted to tell you for a while now, but it was need to know only. And there's something else you should know. Of the 240 or so attendees at the analysts' conference, 142 never made it home.
What?
I don't understand. They didn't pass the test.
The test?
The conference was the test. From the minute you arrived until you walked out, you were under video and audio surveillance, like the suspects we interrogate here. The conference organizers were measuring voice stress, pupil dilation, eye movement, and a dozen other markers. In short, watching the analysts' reactions throughout the conference.
To see if we would withhold information?
Yes. But more importantly, to see who already knew what was being presented. Specifically, which analysts already knew there was a super terror group behind the scenes. The conference was a Clock Tower-wide mole hunt. At that moment, the glass room around Josh seemed to disappear. He could hear David talking in the background, but he was lost in his thoughts. The conference was a perfect cover for a sting. All Clock Tower agents, even analysts, were trained in standard counter-espionage methods. Beating a lie detector was first base, but telling a lie, as if it were true, was much easier than faking an emotional response to a surprise and sustaining the reaction. With credible body metrics for 3 days. It was impossible. But to test every chief analyst? The implication was, Josh, did you hear me? Josh looked up.
No, I'm sorry. It's a lot to take in. Clock Tower has been compromised.
Yes. And I need you to focus now. Things are happening quickly and I need your help. The analyst test was the first step in Clock Tower's firewall protocol. Around the world, right now, the chief analysts who return from the conference are meeting with their station chiefs in quiet rooms, just like this one, trying to figure out how to secure their cells.
You think Jakarta Station has been compromised?
I'd be shocked if it wasn't. There's more. The analyst purge has set events in motion. The plan, firewall protocol, was to screen the analysts for moles and for the remaining chief analysts and station chiefs to work together to identify anyone who could be a double.
Makes sense.
It would have, but we've underestimated the scope of the breach. I need to tell you a little about how Clock Tower is organized. You know about how many cells there are, 200 to 250 at any given time. You should know that we had already identified some of the chief analysts as moles, about 60. They never made it to the conference.
Then who were
actors? Mostly field agents who had worked as analysts before, anyone who could fake it. We had to. Some of the analysts already knew the approximate number of Clock Tower cells, and the actors provided an operational benefit. They could facilitate the 3-day lie detection, ask pointed questions, elicit responses, get reactions.
Unbelievable. How could we be so deeply compromised?
That's one of the questions we have to answer. There's more.
Not all the cells are like Jakarta Station. The vast majority are little more than listening posts. They manage a small group of case officers and send Central the HUMINT and SIGINT they collect. A compromised listening post is bad. It means whoever this global enemy is, they have been using those cells to collect intel and maybe even send us bogus data. We could be essentially blind, Josh said. That's right. Our best-case scenario was that this enemy had co-opted our intelligence gathering in preparation for a massive attack. We now know that that's only half of it. Several of the major cells are also compromised. These are cells similar to Jakarta Station, with intelligence gathering and significant covert ops forces. We are one of 20 major cells. These cells are the last line of defense, the thin red line that separates the world from whatever this enemy is planning. How many are compromised? We don't know. But three major cells have already fallen. Karachi, Cape Town, and Mar del Plata have all reported that the cells' own special forces swept through their HQ, killing most of the analysts and the station chiefs. There have been no communications from them for hours. Satellite surveillance over Argentina confirms the destruction of the Mar del Plata HQ. The Cape Town insurgents were assisted by outside forces. As we speak, firefights are ongoing in Seoul, Delhi, Dhaka, and Lahore. Those stations may hold, but we should assume they will be lost as well. Right now, our own special ops forces could be preparing to take over Jakarta Station. Or it could be happening this second, outside this room. But I doubt that. Why? I believe they'll wait for you to return, given what you know your reliability. Whenever they attack, you'll be at the top of the target list. The morning briefing would be the ideal time for a strike. They are probably waiting for that. Josh felt his mouth go dry. That's why you grabbed me off the elevator. He thought for a moment. So what now? You want me to identify the threats on the staff before the briefing? We initiate a preemptive attack? No, David said, shaking his head. That was the original plan, but we're past that now. We have to assume Jakarta Station will fall. If we're compromised as badly as the other major cells, it's only a matter of time. We have to look at the big picture and try to figure out our adversary's end game. We have to assume that one or more cells will survive and that they will be able to use anything we learn. If not, maybe one of the national agencies. But there's still one question you haven't asked. A very important one. Josh thought for a second. Why now? And why start with the analysts? Why didn't you clean the field operatives first? Very good. David flipped open a folder. 12 days ago, I was contacted by an anonymous source who said two things. One, there was an imminent terrorist attack on a scale we've never seen before. And two, Clock Tower had been compromised. David arranged a few pages. He included a list of 60 analysts that he claimed were compromised. We shadowed them for a few days and confirmed them making dead drops and unauthorized communications. It checked out. The source said there might be more. The rest, you know. The other station chiefs and I organized the analyst conference. We interrogated and quarantined the compromised analysts, replacing them with actors at the conference. Whoever the source is, he either didn't know about the field agents or didn't disclose it for his own reasons. The source refused to meet, and I received no other communications from him. We proceeded with the conference and after, the purge. The source was radio silent. Then, late last night, he contacted me again. He said he wanted to deliver the other half of the intel he promised. Details of a massive attack codenamed Toba Protocol. We were supposed to meet this morning at Mangare Station, but he didn't show. Someone with a bomb did, but I think he wanted to be there. A kid gave me a newspaper with this message right after the attack. David pushed a page across the table. Toba Protocol is real. 4 plus 12 plus 47 equals 4 over 5, Jones. 7 plus 12 plus 47 equals 3 over 8, Anderson. 10 plus 4 plus 47 equals 5 over 4, Ames. Some kind of code, Josh said.
Yes, it's surprising. The other messages were straightforward. But now it makes sense.
I don't understand.
Whatever the code is, it's the real message. It's what the entire setup has been about.
The source wanted the analyst purge to happen so he could send his coded message at the right time, and know it would be decoded by someone who wasn't a double agent. Namely, you. He wanted us focused on cleaning up the analysts and delaying the fireworks until he could send this message. Had we known how thoroughly we had been compromised, we would have quarantined the field operatives first and sent Clock Tower into total lockdown. We wouldn't be having this conversation.
Yeah, but why even bother with a code? Why not send the message in the open like the previous communications?
It's a good question.
He must be under surveillance as well. Communicating whatever he's trying to tell us in the open must have repercussions.
Maybe it would cause his death or speed up this terrorist attack. So whoever is watching him assumes we don't know what the message says yet. That may be why we haven't taken more of the cells down. They still think they can contain Clock Tower.
Makes sense.
It does, but one question still bothered me.
Why me?
Josh thought for a moment.
Right. Why not the director of Clock Tower? All the other Clock Tower station chiefs, or simply alert all the world's intelligence agencies.
They would have more far-reaching power to stop an attack. Maybe tipping them would start the attack early, just like sending the message in the open, or you could be in a unique position to stop the attack.
Josh looked up.
Or you know something.
Very good.
I mentioned earlier that I began investigating this super-terrorist group before I joined Clock Tower.
David stood, walked to the filing cabinet, and withdrew two more folders.
I'm going to show you something I've been working on for over 10 years. Something I've never shown anyone else. Not even Clock Tower.
Chapter 13. Interrogation Room C, West Jakarta Police Detention Center. Jakarta, Indonesia. Kate leaned back in the chair and thought about her options. She would have to tell the investigator how the trial had begun. Even if he didn't believe it, she had to get it on the record in case they tried her.
Stop, she said.
The man paused at the door. Kate set her chair legs down and put her arms on the table.
There's a very good reason why my trial adopted those children.
There's something you should understand.
When I came to Jakarta, I expected to run this trial like any other trial in America. That was my first mistake. We failed, and we changed our approach.
The little man turned from the door, sat down, and listened as Kate described how she had spent weeks preparing for patient recruitment. The trial had hired a contract research organization, CRO, to run the trial, just as they would have in the U.S. In the U.S., pharmaceutical companies focus on developing a new drug or therapy, and when they have something promising, they hire a CRO to test it for them. The CROs find medical clinics with doctors interested in clinical research. The clinics or sites enroll willing patients into the trial, administer the new drug, therapy, then test them periodically for any health problems, adverse events. The CRO keeps close tabs on every site in the trial, reporting results to the sponsor, research organization, who makes their own reports to the FDA or governing body in countries around the world. The end game was a trial with the desired therapeutic effect, without any negative or adverse effects. It was a long road, and less than 1% of drugs that worked in the lab ever made it to pharmacy shelves. There was only one problem. Jakarta and Indonesia at large had no autism clinics and only a handful of specialty practices focusing on developmental disorders. Those clinics weren't experienced in clinical research, a dangerous situation for patients.
The pharmaceutical industry was tiny in Indonesia, mostly because the market was small. Indonesia imported mostly generic drugs, so very few doctors were ever contacted about research. The CRO came up with a novel concept: engage parents directly and run a clinic to administer the therapy. Kate and the trial's lead investigator, Dr. John Helms, met with the CRO at length, searching for any alternatives. There were none. Kate urged Dr. Helms to move forward with the plan, and finally he agreed. They built a list of families within 100 miles of Jakarta that had any child on the autism spectrum. Kate booked an auditorium at one of the nicest hotels in town and invited the families to a presentation. She wrote, rewrote, and revised the trial booklet for days on end. Finally, Ben had barged into her office and said he would leave the trial if she didn't just let it go. They were ready to recruit. Kate relented. The pamphlet went to the ethics committee, then the printer, and they prepared for the event. When the day came, she stood by the door, ready to greet each family as they arrived. She wished her hands would stop sweating. She wiped them on her pants every few minutes. First impressions are everything. Confidence, trust, expertise. She waited. Would they have enough booklets? They had 1,000 on hand, and although they had sent only 600 invitations, both parents could show up. Other families could show up. There was no reliable database or registry of affected families in Indonesia. What would they do? She told Ben to be ready to use the hotel copier just in case. He could prepare copies of the highlights while she talked. 15 minutes passed the hour. The first two mothers appeared. Kate dried her hands again before shaking vigorously and talking just a little too loud. "Great to have you here. Thank you for coming. No, this is the place. Take a seat. We'll get started any moment." 30 minutes passed the hour. An hour past the start time. She circled the six mothers, making small talk. "I don't know what happened. What day did you get the invitation?" "No, we invited others." "I think it must be a problem with the post." Finally, Kate led the six attendees to a small conference room in the hotel to make it less awkward for everyone. She gave a short presentation as one by one, each of the mothers begged off, saying they had children to pick up, jobs to get back to, and the like. Downstairs at the hotel bar, Dr. Helms got drunk as a skunk. When Kate joined him, the gray-haired man leaned close and said, "I told you it wouldn't work. We'll never recruit in this town, Kate. Why the hell? Hey, ho, barkeep. Yeah, over here. I'll have another. Uh-huh, same thing. Good man. What was I saying? Oh, yes, we need to wrap it up quickly. I've got an offer in Oxford. God, I miss Oxford. It's too blasted humid here. Feels like a sauna all of the time. And I must admit, I did my best work there. Speaking of..." He leaned even closer. "I don't want to jinx it by saying the words, Nobel Prize, but I've heard my name's been submitted. This could be my year, Kate." "Can't wait to forget about this debacle. When will I learn? I guess I've got a soft heart when it comes to a good cause." Kate wanted to point out that his soft heart had certainly driven a hard bargain, 3 times her salary, and his name first on any publication or patents, despite the fact that the entire study was based on her postdoctoral research. But she held her tongue and swallowed the last of her Chardonnay. That night she called Martin. "I can't." "Stop right there, Kate. You can do anything you set your mind to. You always have. There are 200 million people in Indonesia, and almost 7 billion on this little world. And as many as 0.5% could be somewhere on the autism spectrum. That's 35 million people, population of Texas. You've sent letters to 600 families. Don't give up. I won't let you. I'll make a call tomorrow morning to Amari Research's head of funding. They'll continue funding you, whether that hack John Helms is on the study or not." The call reminded Kate of the night she had called him from San Francisco, when Martin had promised her Jakarta would be a great place to start over and to continue her research. Maybe he would be right after all. The next morning she walked into the lab and told Ben to order a lot more study booklets and to find translators. They were going out to the villages. They would widen the net, and they wouldn't wait for families to come to them. She fired the CRO. She ignored Dr. Helm's protests. 2 weeks later, they loaded up 3 vans with 4 researchers, 8 translators, and crate after crate of the trial books printed in 5 languages. Indonesian, Malay, Javanese, Sundanese, Madarese, and Batawi. Kate had agonized over the language choices as well. Over 700 distinct languages were spoken throughout Indonesia, but in the end, she had chosen the 5 most commonly spoken in Jakarta and throughout the island of Java. She would be damned if her autism trial would fail due to a communication breakdown. As with the hotel in downtown Jakarta, her preparations were an entirely wasted effort. Upon entering the first village, Kate and her team were amazed. There were no autistic children. The villagers weren't interested in the booklets. The translators told her that no one had ever seen a child with these problems. It didn't make any sense. There should have been at least 2, maybe 3 potential participants in every village, possibly more. At the next village, Kate noticed one of the translators, an older man, leaning against the van while the team and remaining translators went door to door. "Hey, why aren't you working?" Kate had asked. The man shrugged. "Because it won't make any difference." "The hell it won't. Now you better..." The man held up his hands. "I mean no offense, ma'am. I only mean you ask the wrong questions, and you ask the wrong people." Kate scrutinized the man. "Okay, who would you ask? And what would you ask them?" The man pushed off from the van, gestured for Kate to follow, and walked deeper into the village, past the nicer homes. On the outskirts he knocked on the first door, and when a short woman answered, he spoke quickly, in a harsh tone, occasionally pointing at Kate. The scene made her cringe. She self-consciously pulled the lapels of her white coat together. She had agonized over her wardrobe as well, ultimately deciding that projecting a credible clinical appearance was the order of the day. She could only imagine how she looked to the villagers, who were mostly dressed in clothes they had made themselves from scraps, taken home from the sweatshops, or remains of partially disintegrated hand-me-downs. She realized the woman was gone, and Kate stepped forward to question the translator, but he held up a hand as the woman returned to the door, pushing 3 children out to stand before them. They stared at their feet and stood still as statues. The translator walked from child to child, looking them up and down. Kate shifted her weight a bit, contemplating what to do. The children were healthy. None showed even the slightest signs of autism. At the last child, the man bent down and shouted again. The mother quickly said something, but he yelled at her, and she fell silent. The child nervously said 3 words. The translator said something, and the child repeated the words. Kate wondered if they were names, possibly places. The translator stood and began pointing and yelling at the woman again. She shook her head furiously, repeating a phrase over and over. After several minutes of the translator's badgering, she looked down and began speaking in low tones. She pointed to another shack. The translator's voice was soft for the first time, and the woman seemed relieved by his words. She herded the children back inside, almost cutting the last one in half as she quickly closed the door. The scene at the second shack unfolded much like the first. The translator shouted and pointed, Kate stood awkwardly, and the nervous villager presented her 4 children, then waited with worry in her eyes. This time, when the translator asked one of the children his questions, the children said 5 words. Names, Kate believed. The mother protested, but the translator ignored her, pressing the child. When he answered, the large man sprang up, pushed the children and their mother aside, and burst through the door. Kate was caught off guard, but when the mother and children followed into the home, she did as well. The shack was a crowded 3-room hovel. She almost tripped walking through it. At the rear of the home, she found the translator and woman arguing more vehemently than before. At their feet, a small child, a gaunt child, was tied to a wooden beam that held the roof up. He was gagged, but she could hear low rhythmic noises coming from his mouth as he rocked back and forth, hitting his head on the beam. Kate grabbed the translator's arm. "What is this? Tell me what's going on here." The man looked from Kate back to the mother, seemingly caught between his master and a caged animal whose volume and hysterics seemed to grow by the moment. Kate squeezed the man's arm and jerked him toward her, and he began explaining. "She says it is not her fault. He is a disobedient child. He will not eat her food. He will not do as she says. He does not play with the children. She says he does not even answer to his own name." They were all classic signs of autism. A severe case. Kate looked down at the child. The man added, "She insists it is not her fault. She says she has kept him longer than the others, but she cannot..." "What others?" The translator conversed with the woman in a normal tone, then turned to Kate. "Beyond the village, there's a place where they take the children who don't respect their parents. The ones that disobey constantly. That won't be a part of their family." "Take me there." The translator coaxed more information out of the woman, then pointed toward the door for them to leave. The woman called after them. The man turned to Kate. "She wants to know if we will take him." "Tell her yes, and to untie him, and that we will return." The translator led Kate to a patch of deserted forest just south of the village. After an hour of looking, they had still found nothing, but they continued searching. Occasionally, Kate heard the leaves and trees rustle as game moved about. The sun would set soon, and she wondered what this forest would be like then. Indonesia was entirely tropical. The temperature was nearly constant from day to day and season to season. The Javanese jungles were dangerous, untamed areas, home to all sorts of snakes, large cats, and insects. No place for a child. In the distance, she heard screaming, and the translator called to her. "Dr. Warner, come quickly!" She dashed across the dense forest, tripping once and fighting her way through the overgrowth. She found the translator holding a child, even more gaunt than the boy at the shack. Even with his dark brown skin, she could see the dirt and grime caked on his face. He fought the translator's hold like a caged banshee. "Are there any others?" Kate asked. She saw a lean-to, a ragged shelter about 50 yards away. Was there a child lying there? She started for it. "Do not go there, Dr. Warner." He tightened his grip on the child. "There are no others to take back. Please, help me." She took the child's other arm and they escorted him back to the vans. They gathered the research team, then retrieved the child that had been tied to the beam, who they learned was named Addie. The child from the forest had no name, and they knew they would never find his parents or anyone who would ever own up to what had been done to him. Kate named him Surya. When the research team assembled at the van, Kate cornered her translator. "Now, I want you to tell me what you did back there. Exactly what you said."
"I think maybe you do not want to be knowing, Doctor."
"I think I do definitely want to be knowing. Now start talking." The man sighed.
"I told them you are a humanitarian organization who is doing child welfare."
"What?"
The man straightened. "That is what they are thinking you are anyway, so it makes no difference. They do not know what this clinical trial is. They have never heard of such a thing. Look around you. These people just live as they did 1,000 years ago. I tell them you have to see their children and that you will help any that need help. Still, they do not trust us. Some believe they will get in trouble, but many simply worry word will get around. Here it is a dangerous thing to have a child with problems. People keep them out of sight. If word gets around, the other children will have problems finding a mate. They will say, 'Maybe you have his child, and he is a problem like his father's brother.' They will say, 'It is in his blood.' But the children tell the truth when I ask them to name their brothers and sisters. Children do not yet know to lie about this." Kate considered the man's story. It had certainly worked.
She turned to the team.
Okay. This is our new approach.
Dr. Helms stepped toward Kate and the translator.
I won't do it. Lying to a parent to enroll a child in a clinical trial violates basic medical ethics and is simply morally wrong.
He paused for effect.
Regardless of their circumstances or the community's social norms.
He stared at Kate, and then the other staff. Kate interrupted his revelry.
Suit yourself. You can wait in the van, and so can anyone else who wants to leave these kids here to die.
The doctor turned to her to fire another volley, but Ben cut him off.
Well, I'm in. I hate waiting in the van, and killing kids, for that matter.
He turned and started packing up the gear, only pausing to ask the other staff for help. The remaining three assistants reluctantly began to help, and only then did Kate realize how on the fence they had been. She made a mental note to thank Ben, but the pace of the day soon picked up and she forgot. At the next village, the team tossed out the trial booklets, but when the villagers began collecting them, the team shifted to handing the booklets out as insulation for the villagers' homes. The act of goodwill helped to corroborate their story as aid workers, and it was nice for Kate to see the booklets she'd spent so much time on go to good use. Dr. Helms continued protesting, but the rest of the staff ignored him. As the vans filled up with children, his protests tapered off, and by the end of the day, it was clear to everyone that he regretted his actions. Back in Jakarta, he cornered Kate in her office one night, long after the other staff had left.
Listen, Kate, I've been meaning to speak with you.
After, some consideration, and to be frank, after seeing some of the effects of this work on, the children, I have to say I've decided that we are well within the norms of medical ethics and my personal comfort zone, and thus I am well, quite comfortable leading this trial.
He moved to sit down. Kate didn't look up from her document.
Don't sit down, John. There's something I've been meaning to tell you as well. Out there in the field, you put your safety, your personal reputation, ahead of those children's lives. That's unacceptable. We both know I can't fire you, but I simply can't work with you on a trial where children's lives are at stake. If something happened to one of them, if you put them in danger, I couldn't live with it. I informed the trial sponsor, Imari Research, that I would be leaving. And the funniest thing happened. She looked up from the paper. They told me they wouldn't fund the trial without me. So you can either resign, or I will, in which case you'll lose your funding and I'll simply start the same trial with a different name. Oh, and by the way, the movers are coming to pack up your office tomorrow. So whatever you decide, you'll have to find a new lease.
She walked out of the office and left for the night. The next day, Helms left Jakarta for good, and Kate became the project's sole investigator. Kate asked Martin to make a few phone calls, some favors were exchanged, and the study became the legal guardian of every child enrolled. When Kate finished her story, the interrogator stood and said,
"You expect me to believe that?
We're not savages, Miss Warner. Good luck telling that story to a jury in Jakarta."
He left the tiny room before Kate could respond. Outside the interrogation room, the small man walked up to the rotund police chief, who put his sweaty arm around him and said,
"How did it go, Paco?" "I think she's ready, boss."
Chapter 14. Secure comms room, Clock Tower Station HQ, Jakarta, Indonesia. Josh looked out of the glass room at the concrete walls beyond as he tried to digest what David had told him. Clock Tower was compromised. Several major cells were already fighting for their survival. Jakarta Station would soon be under attack, and on top of that, there was an imminent terrorist attack on a global scale. And David needed Josh to unravel a code to stop it. No pressure. David returned from the filing cabinet and sat down at the table again.
"I've been working on a theory I formed 10 years ago, just after 9/11.
"You think this attack is connected to 9/11? Josh asked.
"I do.
"You think this is an Al-Qaeda operation?
Not necessarily. I believe Al-Qaeda only carried out the 9/11 attacks. I believe another group, a global corporation called Imari International, actually planned, funded, and benefited